Well, good morning, friends. For those of you that are new and don't know, my name is Ryan, and I am the priest here. We are currently in a series working through the Gospel of Matthew that's going to take us through the spring and most likely through the summer. And we're just looking at the parables of Jesus in this Gospel. Now, last week, Robin, who's not in the room now, she wonderfully spoke on the parable of the sower, where Jesus describes himself as a farmer who liberally spreads his the seed, the word of the gospel, throughout the world. Now, the seed falls on four different areas or types of soil in that passage of Scripture. The soil is representative of the heart of the person. And so the first area is the path, which is the word gets trampled upon by the hardship of life and gets snatched up by birds, it says, which is the evil one. The second is the rocky ground, where the seed gets no root and then dries up in the midst of tribulation or hardship. The third is among the thorns, the cares of the world and riches choke out the word of the gospel. It's an interesting look on that specific example, because the cares of this world and riches seem to be counter to what's being offered in the gospel of Jesus. So basically, everything that Jesus is offering is provision, is the grace you need, is salvation, and riches are the lie. To say, take care of yourself, do it yourself, earn it yourself. And thinking this way chokes out the gospel. The fourth is the good soil. And the good soil understands the gospel and yields fruit. So it grows into fruit that bears 160 and 30-fold. So basically the idea is that it's received, it's consumed almost by the good soil, dependent upon by the good soil, and this bears a harvest. And so the main point of that parable is that true followers of Jesus are fruitful. This is kind of the uncomfortable result of that parable. A true reception of the good word, the good news that God is love and God saves and God redeems and God helps and God empowers us to goodness, should lead to a reproduction of the good word. So let me put it this way. True disciples make disciples. That's the conclusion of that parable. That the way of Jesus requires a season of deep reception. And that's what's lacking in the first three examples of that parable. We need a season of life where we hear the gospel and deeply consume it. Like we hear the message of Jesus and we give our whole lives to receiving Jesus to the parts of ourselves that need it most. Is that fair? We all need that. So this saves us from, I have some kind of intellectual understanding of what the way of Jesus is or who Jesus is or what Jesus has accomplished. Great. We have an intellectual idea of that, even agreement with that. But all the parts of me that are most desperate, all the parts of me that are most broken, that I'm still trying to do it on my own, unless that theory, that idea of what God has done, meets with the reality of what we need, what good is it? It doesn't bear fruit, does it? So every true follower of Jesus needs a period of time, which to be honest is ongoing forever. This is what our daily prayer, what that space in our life turns into. Is you have a season where you receive the gospel, and for a few years you just pour your whole life into receiving Jesus. And then what that turns into is a lifestyle of prayer and of reception that's ongoing of receiving Jesus for the continuing needs of your life. But your focused energy shifts from just receiving it for myself to helping other people receive it. This is the work of caring, loving for, walking with people as they try and figure out how does the biggest stuff Jesus has done fit with the biggest stuff that's happened to me. Make sense? So this is the parable. It's this idea of going, good soil goes, this gospel's for me, and I need it, and I want it, and I treasure it and consume it. And then when this happens, it leads to then helping other people do the same. Doesn't that just kind of naturally make sense? I have found everything I could be looking for. I want you to find it too. Yes? So this is how Jesus is describing the Christian life. What's missing in those first three examples, though, is this season of reception. It's where other things take our focus. Other things become our false saviors. Other things are what we look to help us, and so the gospel just gets choked out, and we never tap into its reality to change and save. It just stays theory. I tried that once. I heard that once. I used to go to church. Sound familiar? So what we see, though, in this is that the result is a Christian who never realizes their potential in the gospel. They never find that lasting sense of forgiveness or that functional freedom or ultimately that fruitfulness to create more disciples. And so that kind of Christianity is actually, it might be living, still goes to church, but on the inside feels dead. And Jesus is saying he wants to push them through to go, what's the true state of your soil? So the true follower of Jesus then wants to take it to that degree of fruitfulness, where not only are we passing it on to, say, our kids, but our friends, our neighborhoods, our work situations, the community that we live in. We're seeking to make new apprentices of Jesus. 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. Different levels of fruitfulness based on capacity and based on stage of life, but this is how Jesus describes what the result of a follower of him would look like. Somebody who makes more. That's challenging, isn't it? It's like, ah, dang, have I made more? You know, you're asking that question naturally. Jesus' next parable is going to speak to that question for us. Because here's the thing, we want all of Jesus to the point of transformation. True? And we want to actually be able to hand it to other people. We want to see other people have what we long for. True? But isn't this world hard? And so there's this frustration of like, this is what I want to do, but I'm barely doing the first part. I'm barely holding on to Jesus. Anyone feel that? Let alone fruitfulness everywhere. So this next parable offers us some more comfort, but also some more vision. Okay? Verse 24. He put another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field." Verse 25. "But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed seeds among the wheat and went away." So here's what we see here. The Son of Man sows good seed. The Son of Man is Jesus. Jesus is again pictured here as a landowner and a farmer who has a field which he owns and has authority over it. The good seed, he says, is his sons and daughters being sent out into the world. So now the parable's shifting a little bit. Originally, the seed was just this proclamation of the gospel. Now he's being more specific to say, you're, the follower of Jesus, the good seed that he's spreading out into the world. And we're meant as the disciples to then share that good news which we have received. Now, while the servants were sleeping, the enemy of Jesus comes and sows bad seed, which produces weeds. And so the weeds, he explains later in the passage, are the sons and daughters of the evil one. Remember, these are the words of Jesus himself. And the enemy who sowed them, Jesus says, is the devil. So here's what this tells us. This is very, quite helpful. This is why there's so much evil in the world. Jesus is saying he's not the only actor in the world. There's also evil at work within the world. Intentionally, wherever Jesus is seeking to plant his good seed, the evil one is also going to plant evil seed. Where Jesus is seeking to plant good people, the devil is going to come and try to plant bad people. That's essentially what Jesus is saying. And this is why frustration and futility are always at work in your home, in your neighborhood, in your schools, your jobs, and guess what? In your church. Evil has sons and daughters. Who's uncomfortable with that kind of statement? Right? If you're a good Canadian, you're like, well, we don't say that. Unless we're talking politics. But this is what Jesus is saying. Evil has sons and daughters. And that language is meant to communicate that there are people in this world that share evil's nature. Received it, identify with it, love it. That's what Jesus is saying. Verse 26, so when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared also. Now, the word Jesus uses here for weed is known as a darnel. It's a European ryegrass. And the problem with darnel is that it is virtually identical to wheat as it grows, except for one thing. It does not produce fruit. It doesn't produce a harvest. It's just a grass. So what this weed does is eat up all the nutrients around it, causing the wheat to not reach its full potential. Who feels like that in their life? Do you ever have that sense where you're just like, I love Jesus, I want to do good in the world, but all this trouble is making that very difficult. All of this trouble is sucking all the energy out of me. Anyone feel that way? I live this. Even you can have all the best intentions for your week, and then what do you spend all your time doing? Navigating difficulties. So here's the problem. By the time it's being identified, their roots are all intertwined with the wheat. And in this, Jesus pictures non-believers being mixed in with believers in the world and evil being mixed in with good. Wouldn't it be so much easier if it was just separate, simple? And Jesus is saying that this is the way the devil works, intentionally sowing bad people into places that he is trying to sow good things. And so this world then is full of weeds, and they aren't there because of our master. They aren't there because the master is evil. They are there because the devil is. That's how Jesus describes the world and its problems. Verse 27, and the servants of the master of the house came and said to him, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds? Isn't this a common question of God in our culture today? The servants realized that the seed the master's sown doesn't seem to be producing only good things. What's with all these bad things? It must be his fault because he bought the seed, sowed the seed. The seed's his responsibility in their minds. Anyone think like that? The logical conclusion for the servants is that the master must have made a mistake. And if he's truly Lord over his own lands and was the one who chose and sowed the seed, he must be responsible for this mess. Aren't you in control of this? Why have you allowed these things to happen? Do we ever ask these kind of questions? I do. Verse 28, this is the master's response. He said to them, an enemy has done this. I like the simplicity of the answer. There's no equivocation. There's no self-doubt in the master. It's not a conundrum to him of like, I don't know. He's just like, an enemy's done this. So the servants, I like this too, are trusting of their master. They're like, oh, too bad. And they offer this. Then do you want us to go and gather them? So no fault lies with him. They're asking an obvious question. They see the problem. They're like, well, then let's fix it. Let's go gather them up. This is the natural inclination, isn't it? I think this is a natural inclination for pastors and leadership in church. We see weeds at work. Shouldn't we just pull them out and kick them out? I've worked with guys that like that idea. But notice Jesus' instructions here, verse 29. But he said, no. Lest in gathering the weeds, you root up the wheat along with them. So what does this reveal about the heart of Jesus? Notice the carefulness and the non-anxiousness of the master. Now, when you have a garden and you see weeds in the garden, what do? You want to pull them out. Eleanor up here is like a master gardener. And that's just good care, isn't it, Eleanor, to just pull the weeds out. So why is Jesus choosing not to do something that's so obviously right to do? As far as the gardening principles go, because what are the weeds going to do? They're going to choke out the life of all the things that you planted. So verse 30, watch what he says. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at harvest time I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn. So here's his plan. His plan is let them grow together because the fruitfulness is less important to me than the wheat, the stalk itself. So this is Jesus' value system right now. So what we looked at in the first parable is this idea that the parable of the sower is saying that Jesus reveals that a true believer will and must bear fruit, right? Isn't that what we... And now he's saying in the parable of the weeds, he's revealing that bearing fruit is going to be frustrated by evil. But for the sake of those he is seeking to save and has saved, he's going to allow them to grow together for now. Because here's the deal. Jesus could say it's paramount that you have the premier amount of fruitfulness that your potential holds for you. But to do so, he has to cut people out of the kingdom prematurely. And so here what he's saying is your growth and your fruitfulness, he is not going to prioritize over you. And here's the thing I've seen in the church. Like, I've worked in environments where we get this idea of, like, this is what ideal Christianity looks like. And anyone who's not functioning according to this ideal, we're going to deal with them. We're going to deal with that problem. And if they don't shape up, live up to this ideal, then they got to ship out. Now, in some ways, you look at it and you go, yeah, because that's the highest expression of the gospel, and that's beautiful, and we should aspire for that. But here's what that does. It puts us into a position where, who is qualified to make that call? Am I qualified for that? Is our council qualified for that? How about you, Jeffrey? You qualified? He's like, maybe. I know for a fact that wouldn't be Jeffrey's heart. Because here's the thing. If Jesus puts us in that position, now, this is different than church discipline, and this is different than discipleship issues and having hard conversations and having healthy conflict. I'm not saying we don't do any of those things. But here Jesus is saying, this is not going to be your job. This is not your job to determine this. That my design, even for the church and within the world, is that we're going to have a mix of people growing up here, and it's going to be a little bit messy. Because if you take that as your job, you're more likely to become like the Pharisees than you are like Jesus. So what does that risk in you? That risks your spiritual health, doesn't it? Because now you're no longer focused on your deep, authentic, specific reception of the gospel for your life. You're now weighing everybody else's life. What does that do to your inner life? As rot, that will rot out whatever growth you've got on the inside. Not to mention all of this that's growing around us and all of its messes and all of its evil and its sinfulness are the very people that Jesus is seeking to save. So if we cut them all out, so we think, we're cutting out our mission, which ultimately cuts out our fruitfulness. Who are we going to disciple if we kick out everybody who doesn't measure up? We're just going to disciple each other up here. And who's up here anyway? So Jesus' design is wisdom. Because if you seek to uproot this, you'll uproot the whole gospel. It'll sour the community, ins and outs, thems versus us. And here Jesus is saying, no, this is about an authentic reception of the gospel and a loving serving that others would receive it also. So let both grow together until the harvest. Verse 39 to 42, Jesus explains what the harvest is and what it looks like. He says, the harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers. I love that language. Causes of sin, and throw them into the fiery furnace. So all the way the New Testament talks about this, the way Jesus teaches on this, all people from all generations and all cultures will one day stand before him and their lives will be weighed. The wheat that the good seed made will be gathered into his barn, and he treasures that gathering, that harvest, he treasures and takes into his barn, into his kingdom. The weeds that the bad seed made will be gathered up to be burned in the fiery furnace, he says. Verse 42, he explains, in that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. All throughout the scriptures, especially when you read like the Old Testament and you read the Psalms, what you hear is this groaning from deep inside human history. That all the people who've been oppressed, all the people who have gotten the raw deals, all the people who have been tormented by evil in this world are weeping. And the scriptures collect these tears, these groans, these prayers, these petitions to God saying, will you not act against these horrors? And human history doesn't care about those people. Sure, they write it down, but think of all the people that have been lost, all the people that have suffered, all the people that have starved, all the people that have been killed in wars. Is every name collected by human history? No. But the scriptures seem to communicate that this is what God is doing. He's collecting every single sorrow and every name and every oppressed person and every murdered and stolen from people. Every single person, God is hearing their weeping. And all the self-righteous, and this is very old, ancient language, is this, The self-righteous always gnash their teeth. I don't know how to gnash my teeth. Maybe it's because I got a big overbite. I don't know. But it's just awkward. I don't know how to do it. But what's communicated in the practice is this like sneering, self-righteous, shaming look upon the broken. That the righteous, the elites, look down on the impoverished and the sick and the diseased and the lame. They look down on them and gnash their teeth with disgust. This is how human history has experienced life in an evil world. Those who are oppressed are silenced, and the self-righteous and the powerful sneer and shame the broken and the lowly. Here, Jesus describes an eternity where the tables are finally turned. And the powerful now weep. And the self-righteous feel their shame for what they've done. Evil does not and cannot evade the righteous reach of Jesus. This is how Jesus describes himself. And he says, every cause of evil in this world, every cause of evil in your life, whether demonic, an evil spirit, or human, will be held accountable by God in Christ. Now, here's the thing. Cushy Western world thinkers don't like the idea of this kind of justice. But I'll tell you something. Those who are unhomed long for this kind of justice. Those who are screwed over in business deals long for this kind of justice. Those who have been starved of food and a livelihood long for this kind of justice. The world in its broken, most heart-wrenching places longs for a God who will do something and fix this and end evil forever. And Jesus is saying, I am the one who will do it, and I'm the only one qualified because of how deep my humility is, because of how desperate my love is, because of how sacrificial my care for you is. It's all of the work of Jesus that we've seen in his humble birth and his serving the broken and healing the sick and dying for the sinner that qualifies him and only qualifies him to judge evil ever. That's the way it's set up. This is how Jesus understands himself. Not only am I gentle and lonely and lowly, but I'm strong enough and righteous enough and committed enough to put an end to evil forever. That's the full gospel of Jesus. And this is where he says, finally they'll get what they've done to the world. They'll understand it. They'll feel it. They'll weep with self-awareness. And they'll feel the gnashing of teeth of true goodness look down on them and say, nobody bought your bull all these years. And God knows and God follows through. Now, on the flip side, all of evil will be dealt with. And then verse 43, Jesus says, then the righteous will shine. Shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who are the righteous? Is it those without sin or without evil? This whole idea of wheat and the tares growing up together being indistinguishable, I go, yeah, it is. As much as we believe in Jesus, we're still got our messes, don't we? You compare me to everyone on my block, and you're going to see that there are people on my block that don't believe in Jesus, that do good things in some areas better than I do. So here's the truth of this parable. We're relatively indistinguishable. We're all hurting people in some ways. We're all contributing to the evil and the brokenness in this world. So who's the righteous? Who's going to be able to stand at the end and go, I did it all right? Not me. The righteous are those who he makes righteous. The righteous are those who are made clean by his sacrifice. The righteous are those he pours all of his goodness and love into. Our payment for sin and evil doesn't get avoided. Our payment of sin and evil gets paid for by Christ. That's the gospel. Because it's not like we got the out. We got the Jesus card. We got the VIP pass. We skipped the judgment. And God's like, oh, all good. There's no out. It's we're holding up Christ and saying, he paid what I made. He paid what I deserved. He paid what I earned. All the debt that I accrued, he paid for it with his life. That's what we're believing about the gospel. That his death wasn't just symbolic, it was specific to the evils we committed in this world. So our righteousness then comes from our union with him, where not only is the bad relieved, but the good is imputed, put in. The good, the holy, and the beautiful is active and at work within us, in our innermost being. And so the picture he gives then of eternity for his sons and daughters is that they shine in goodness. That heaven comes to earth and God fixes what's broken here forever, and we live in a state of unimpeded goodness. Isn't that what we want for the world? And he's saying the way that that goodness will spread through the world is that he will be at its center and we will reflect him, we'll shine like him. And this world, fraught by constant conflict between good and evil, good will win completely. And evil will be destroyed completely. And that we give all of our energies and all of our life and all of our personhood and all of our being to love, to cultivating and creating a world of love. This is the vision of Jesus. And it's all in the kingdom of who? Of our Father. Is this a good enough vision yet? This is how Jesus pictures his mission completed. Evil's done, and goodness reigns and shines like the sun. And then he ends with these words, he who has ears, let him hear. We've heard this, some of us have heard this before. So when we hear the parables, we have all this, we've got 2,000 years of church history explaining this to us. But imagine hearing this for the first time and just being like, being one of the disciples and going, I'm gonna need a minute. I'm going to need a minute to take this in, to digest this, what you're saying about the future. It could be this good, all things, the whole world, no evil. And then this, he who has ears, let him hear, is a question of, can you hear it? Can you hear the message? Can you hear the song? Does it actually call to you? Is this meant for you? Can you hear the heart of Jesus in the parable that you're called to bear this good fruit? And that he doesn't expect that to mean that it will be without difficulty or without even the resistance of evil. And that your job is not to hunt out and remove the weeds in the world. Your job is to consume the good news of grace in Jesus for yourself. and seek to spread it to others who can hear it. This is what you're made for. Or you'll hear it and go, I've heard it before. Or that doesn't sound possible. But then you've got to ask yourself, what's your alternative vision? And who's going to accomplish that vision? Are there actually better visions out there? Are there actually more compelling ways? Are there proven paths to this kind of beauty? But for us, we see Jesus and we go, only he could be good enough to accomplish this. It's all about him from beginning to end. It's all about how great he is. So then our response for those who can hear is to go, I believe in this Jesus. That's the most responsible response we can give. Is this is the Jesus I believe in. And all it does is recommit us and turn us back to the deep work of, I need to receive this Jesus for these problems. I need this Jesus for my mess at home. I need to be honest about my evil in my life so that it might have the righteousness of Jesus in it. And this is why I always say at the end of every sermon, let's turn our hearts to the table. Because at the table, we humbly confess our mess and our sins and receive of the reality of grace in the presence of Jesus. So let's do that now. If you're comfortable with it, you can close your eyes.